You're listening to New Books in History. I'm your host, Dexter Fergie. Today I have a very special episode in which I'll be speaking to Jeffrey Byrne about his brilliant book called Mecca of Revolution, Algeria, Decolonization, and the Third World Order. It was published by Oxford University Press in 2016 and was reissued in paperback just last year. It's a special episode because Jeff is a mentor of mine. I took a class with him all the way back in the fourth year of my undergraduate, and then during my MA, he was one of my thesis advisors. And so Jeff has played a sizable role in my own career and interests. But it's also a special episode because we're talking about his award-winning book, Mecca of Revolution. It places Algeria at the center of so many of the 20th century's international dynamics: decolonization, the Cold War, détente, third worldism, the non-aligned movement, and several other dynamics. It challenges common understandings of where international history took place and who its protagonists were. The book begins with an international reading of the Algerian War of Independence, which took place between 1954 and 1962, and then traces how Algerian revolutionaries, upon securing independence from France, built up a powerful, internationally connected post-colonial state in the 1960s and 70s. The book is filled with many innovative arguments that we just had to discuss, and so our conversation is on the longer side, but hopefully you'll find it worthwhile. I know I did. I'm speaking with Jeff Byrne about his book, Mecca of Revolution, Algeria, Decolonization, and the Third World Order. Thanks for being on the show, Jeff.
Thanks very much for having me.
Absolutely. And we should probably give our audience just a slight disclaimer or perhaps conflict of interest. You used to be one of my advisors when I was doing my MA at UBC.
Yeah, it's rank corruption here, which is my style.
Yeah, great. Just to begin our conversation, what drew you to becoming an international historian?
Well, I think what ultimately really drove me to my intellectual historical curiosities, when I think back about it, I didn't have a plan, but it actually turned out there was quite a degree of consistency with many of the things I studied at the undergraduate level. I was sort of a teenager in the 1990s. I went to university in the late 90s, and coming from Ireland on the one hand, and also sort of being situated between the UK and the US, and how much of a sort of impression politics there makes on you. And it was just very much this era of the sort of the post-Cold War era, these strong narratives of sort of a post-ideological age and centrism, and the mainstream political narrative being that there was no sort of real ideological debate to be had anymore. The left, revolutionaries, communism, that was all discredited nonsense. And I think combined with that is sort of being in Ireland as well. There's an element of that, because Irish politics are a bit funny in the sense that the two largest parties, or traditionally at any rate, the most powerful political parties, are ideologically actually very similar. And the reason why there's two of them sort of goes back to the Civil War, just after Irish independence, and sort of more a sort of, a schism than a sort of an ideological differentiation on the spectrum. I think that just always made me very curious about sort of revolutionary ideologies. I was drawn into Russian history as an undergraduate. I took quite a few classes and sort of directed studies in Russian history, getting interested in the Soviet Union and so on. And it's something that only occurred to me afterwards when I was already in graduate school, but my undergraduate thesis, dissertation essay, senior essay in my last year was actually on the French Communist Party in the early 20s and its ties to the Bolsheviks, which ended up being, at least in many thematical ways, extremely similar to my later interests in graduate school, although that only occurred to me after the fact.
Hmm. Great. That's really fascinating. It seems like you've always been interested in the question of ideology and its relationship to revolution. And it's something that we'll be talking about a lot today. So your book is a history of Algerian decolonization and state building, but it's also a history of South-South internationalism. Can you share with listeners what you sought to accomplish when you set out to do this project?
When I set out to do the project, well, I should say that when I set out to do the project, I wasn't even necessarily intending to do a, because it was my doctoral dissertation and then evolved into the book. But when I first started on the project, it was actually just for my master's degree, my master's thesis. I was studying at the London School of Economics. And so I wasn't even thinking in terms of a long-term plan. I took a course with Arne Westad that was on revolutions in the Third World and the Cold War in the Third World. And the course was essentially his book, Global Cold War, that came out shortly after that. And I found that very, very interesting material. The stuff we were reading in that class was very interesting. And thematically, it was very much on the kind of topics I was interested in, but also looking at parts of the world that I wouldn't say I wasn't not interested in them, but they weren't areas that I had sort of necessarily been drawn to or even necessarily visited much at that point in time. I had thought that I would do something about the Soviet Union or maybe Soviet involvement in the developing world for my dissertation. But I did this, I sort of wrote this master's thesis thinking, well, it seems like an interesting, it was on sort of Algerian foreign policy after independence and its ties to revolutionary movements. And I was just thinking that it was a thing that was, you know, I'd be working on it for a few months. I'd learn about a place that I didn't know very much about. I was drawn to it by Piero Gleizes' book, Conflicting Missions, that was on Cuban involvement in Africa. And I had a chapter on Cuban ties to Algeria that was what first got me interested in the topic. And Arne thought it had potential as a subject for a doctoral dissertation and encouraged me to go on and do that at LSE with him, which I did. So to a certain extent, I sort of got into it. I was deep into the project, committed to the project before sort of even thinking about it as, well, what am I trying to get out of this multi-year project? I do remember thinking clearly once I was sort of in the early stages of the PhD that I wanted it to, if someone was reading it, to feel on the one hand that I had proven that if you are interested in sort of contemporary late 20th century international affairs, the history of international affairs, then Algeria is important to know about. I wanted to show that Algeria was relevant to people who perhaps might not necessarily have thought of themselves interested in Algeria, but thematically interested in the sort of broad subject matter. And at the same time, I wanted people who knew Algeria or sort of North African history to recognize the country in what I was writing. And I wanted it to sort of be an international history focused on a particular place, or international or global history focused on a particular place, a particular country that was sort of true to both. That was a good history of Algeria and a good history of international and global dynamics. Then I think as I was getting more into this, sort of more revising it for the book and thinking about what it all means, what it means to me, what it means to the field, I was, in a sense, the focus on South-South connections and sort of global and international history that's not primarily sort of told from, oriented around the traditional great powers in the Northern Hemisphere. In a sense, that came naturally out of the material. I just felt like that was true to the history. I did know that I didn't want to do a sort of a history of Algeria told largely from the French perspective, or that there's some sort of a, regardless of the sources you're using, that there's a sort of default that the Algeria history is not an offshoot of French history. And I think perhaps that's where being Irish and sort of having that wasn't something that occurred to me beforehand, but there's certainly parallels between Algeria's relationship with France and Ireland's relationship with the UK. And then in terms of it being very oriented around relations with other countries and movements and people and groups and political forces and ideas that are largely coming from the Southern Hemisphere or the Third World, that's important to me, but it was also just, I think, a accurate reflection of the sources and the history and what I was getting from the Algerian side of things.
Yeah, so that's something that I would love to hear more about, just the sources. You know, this book is based off of really just like a tremendous amount of archival research, archives from really around the world, like many, many continents. And in those archives, you were really able to gather information that other researchers were just unable to find. So I would love to hear more about your experience with these archives, what were some of the archival obstacles that you faced, and how did you, the historian, overcome them?
I was writing a history of Algeria. It initially started out, actually, when I started the dissertation, the PhD, the initial conception of the book was looking at Algerian foreign policy after independence, sort of Algerian foreign policy in the 60s, with a particular, maybe sort of external relations is a better term, because I certainly was especially interested in perhaps not necessarily conventional foreign policy, but relations with other national liberation movements and revolutionary groups and this kind of thing. And then as it developed, I ended up sort of talking a lot as well about the sort of pre-independence, independence struggle in Algeria, as well as the post-62 period. And so I knew starting out that I very much wanted to be able to use Algerian sources, Algerian archives, especially as I was thinking at the outset that I was focused on post-1962, after independence from France, at the end of this huge war, and very much interested in foreign policy type things, that ideally I could look at the records of Algeria's foreign ministry or other sort of government bureaucracies or that kind of thing, the same way one would do if you were writing something about U.S. relations with the world, say, or British relations with the world. You trundle off to the National Archives and look at the State Department records and that kind of thing that they'll let you see. No one had been able to see that material before that I was aware of. The one encouraging precedent was Matt Connolly's book, which had come out a few years prior to prior to me starting the dissertation. That was 2002, perhaps. That was on the Algerian War of Independence from 1954 to 1962, and he had gotten to see some Algerian sources from the Algerian archives that were specifically of the FLN, the Front de Libération Nationale, the independence movement from 54 to 62. So that was encouraging. I wanted to look at sort of post 62, but I thought, well, there's certainly seems that there's it's not sort of totally unprecedented. But the people I asked before I went the first time were not terribly encouraging, and thought that when I sort of asked people who'd worked on Algeria and had sort of written books in Algeria and sort of essentially said it was a lost cause, but I went and tried anyway. And I mean, that was a very big focus of my training at LSE, with training with Arnie Westhead in particular and some of his other students. A lot of people that were working on sort of post-communist countries or other parts of the sort of global south / third world. And there was a strong emphasis on doing research in situ and trying to do this sort of decentered history of the Cold War, as they're calling it, a sort of polycentric history and terms like that. So it was definitely, perhaps Such things aren't always possible, but that was definitely a sort of instilled as a priority and was definitely preferable. And so I put a lot of effort into it from the outset, and luckily it panned out, and it was profoundly changed the project. The staff at the Archive National in Algeria, the National Archive Center, where I was asking to do a kind of project that they hadn't really worked on a project like that before. There were some, as you might expect, sort of some hesitancy. It took a a lot of explaining and conversations. But ultimately, I felt that they ended up being quite supportive, and certainly wouldn't have been possible at all without the support of the archive staff and the archives administration.
Mm-hmm. Do you have like a particular technique? I'm thinking about some of the PhD students that might be listening to this conversation, and I'm just wondering if you could think of like one technique that helped you overcome these obstacles that that had harried other researchers before you.
I think my main technique was persistence, sort of stubbornness, a fear of going back to London, sort of ashamed that I hadn't gotten into the archives. I wouldn't be able to hold my head high amongst these other graduate students doing all sorts of amazing work in amazing places. So the fear of mortal embarrassment. It did take a long time. I did know that I expected that. Well, this is the thing that hasn't happened before. They don't have people sort of dropping in every day, that I'm not seeing work come out that are using these kind of sources. So I felt that there might be political obstacles, in the sense that it might be, presumably at least a somewhat closed political culture. They're not sort of, so they might sort of have a sort of a policy reluctance to let someone see this kind of material. I thought there might also be they might not be used to this sort of supporting this kind of project. So I expected that it might take a while, and I expected that the default answer for everything would be no. If in doubt, I mean, who am I? I'm just some Irish guy showing up asking to, look at high level documents of state. Complicated by the fact, of course, that many of the people whose documents and sort of letters I'm asking to look at were at least at that time currently very senior figures still in Algerian politics, including the president and so on. Many of them had, extremely long political careers. So it's only understandable that they wouldn't necessarily jump at the opportunity as soon as I showed up to sort of let me in to see everything I wanted. So I went expecting that it would take a long time and it'd be a conversation, and that there'd be a conversation about sort of both policy and also how it might work out in practice. And so I think my main asset was patience, sort of willingness to stay. But the first visa they gave me was for 3 months. And so I just made a point of going to the National Archives, the reading room, just about every day that they were open during those 3 months. And while I was there, I was sort of looking at historical newspapers and that kind of thing that were useful, but wasn't sort of my purpose of going there, but just to be able to pass the time. And whenever the opportunity arose, I'd sort of discuss my project more with various people and sort of make an appointment to talk to senior administrators. Of course, they're not going to, you might have to wait a while to talk to them. They have other responsibilities. And so I think that sort of persistence, expecting that all the initial answers would be no, but sort of not necessarily, just taking that at face value. I mean, not being rude, but asking to have a conversation about a thing. I think sometimes people make the mistake of sort of, sending emails or sending letters or something, and then getting a negative or not very encouraging response back and sort of leaving it at that.
Yeah, I think, okay, so the technique would be time, persistence, and fear and shame, apparently.
Basically, graduate school.
Yeah, exactly.
Shame, forwards. Time, yeah.
I think this archival, your archival experience is really what enabled you to tell this very international story that's like centered in a place that we actually don't know very much about. I think that whatever you did in the archives, I thank you for it. Getting into the book itself now, one of the key theses of your book relates to ideology, or rather lack thereof, among the Algerian revolutionaries. Instead of a coherent and fully articulated ideology, they preferred thinking more about like the practice of revolution or the technique of revolution. This meant that they were really borrowing from eclectic sources. In the first bit of your book, you talk about how they borrowed from Woodrow Wilson and Lenin in their approach to revolution and state making. Can you walk listeners through this argument and how they, how they were thinking about Wilson and Lenin together?
Yeah, well, it's, I wouldn't say that's the Algerian revolution lacked an ideology so much as the particular argument I'm making that you're referring to there is there's a deliberate sort of tactical choice in the early stages of, and I should say when I say Algerian revolution, I might use it in two different terms because in two different senses, because on the one hand you have 1954 to 1962 is the actual War of Independence or the Algerian Revolution, this huge war of national liberation from France. But I also sort of talk about the Algerian Revolution in terms of continuing beyond 1962 and the sort of the revolutionary goals and socialist goals and sort of the independent Algerian state and its efforts to support national liberation movements elsewhere and so on. I'm looking at all of the minutes of the higher ranks of the FLN, the National Liberation Movement from 54 to 62. And you can see these very interesting debates about sort of policy and revolutionary strategy and ideology going on. And one of the things that struck me was why so much of this material was really interesting, because of course it was almost like a sort of a graduate seminar on this subject, because of course, if you actually go and look at them, it's the revolution is mostly sort of leadership cadres and sort of the sort of political officers and those kind of things. Many of them really are sort of graduate students or their equivalent of that age. Some of them leave university studies to join the FLN, to join the revolution, sort of young people who are 22, 23 years old. Maybe they sort of, get a law degree or even leave law school and are sort of sent off to be the FLN's envoy or sort of diplomat in places like India or the New York and the UN for that matter, or Europe. And so they you have a lot of sort of, I think the quality that they felt reading some of these minutes, the minutes of these high level conversations that we're having about sort of what's our strategy, what are our goals, what's our ideology. And it's really interesting because it's these sort of, in some ways, these sort of basic fundamental questions of principle about what's the revolution stand for, what's it about, what's the issue with the Algerian people, why should the revolution exist. But it also has to be very pragmatic because the revolution is underway. There's guerrilla fighters, there's Mujahideen fighting the hills, and the French are sort of killing them and arresting them as quickly as they can, and the whole country is plunged into war. So there's a sort of there's a sort of on the one hand a conversation about basic principles, on the other hand pragmatical and very urgent and in human terms like are very urgent realities are imposing themselves, and sort of the most greatest human stakes are at play. And there's an interesting early decision made to indeed, which is sort of behind the genesis of the FLN itself in 54, to in a sense table deep philosophical discussions about what's the revolution about, what's the Algerian national identity about, sort of how important is religion to it, how important is Islam to it, how important is sort of different sort of linguistic and sort of sub-region, sort of sub-national linguistic or cultural identities, or is it explicitly socialist or not? So in a sense, what the defining trait of the, because there were other, there was a very active political scene of many different, in Algeria before 1954, before the FLN was created, expressing discontent with the colonial status quo in many different respects. And in a sense, what actually differentiated the FLN, and they were quite explicit about this, its founders at the beginning, that the reason how they justified creating this new entity when different political parties and movements already existed was that they said that they were explicitly about the means, about action, rather than philosophy and ideas and identity and sort of defining things and doctrinal debates. And they said that's what distinguishes us from the politicians who they're sort of trying to shove to the side, and they do shove to the side successfully. It's not about what defines our revolution. What defines a revolutionary is not sort of what you think or what your goals are, because many of the politicians that they were supplanting were themselves calling for independence and so on and so forth. Said what defines a revolution is not the goals, but what is actions, what a revolution is willing to do, namely to fight, to risk their own life, to sacrifice their own life if need be, to take other lives, to begin this armed revolt. And they essentially said, we can argue about, you know, what the revolution means forever and never get on with anything. We'll just be another bunch of, you know, sort of revolutionaries talking big talk in cafes, but never actually undertaking the revolution. And so that was a tactical decision that was incredibly consequential for all sorts of reasons. Ended up being extremely successful because they completely transformed the Algerian political landscape. The revolution does take off. The other political figures who had pre-existed in Algeria basically had to either join within a year or two, within 2 years, basically the political landscape was completely changed. All the other sort of political figures had either joined the FLN or being shoved to the side or eliminated. So that decision to just sort of take action and to focus on the methods of revolution rather than the theory of it was deliberate and intentional, and at least in the short term, very successful. And some of those methods you're talking about, the point I make in the first two chapters, I suppose, of the book are, or one of the points anyway, is that if you're looking at the influence of sort of things like sort of Wilsonian internationalism was important, the influence of sort of Bolshevism, Leninism and Maoism, those sort of communist revolutionary influences, those were also important. But much more so, I think, about the sort of the practical aspects of those different revolutionary ideas. And I argue that the FLN, in a sense, sort of took the practices of Wilsonian diplomacy. And they had this, it's particularly famous amongst revolutionary movements, the FLN, for sort of pioneering this extremely well-developed sort of political diplomatic wing that sort of conducts public relations campaigns globally and brings attention to the Algerian cause and tries to gain sympathy for it internationally, and become so successful that basically no revolutionary or political or nationalist movement or liberation movement that comes afterwards up to the present day, they basically all tried to do the same thing. It seems obvious that you need to do that now because it's so successful. And I think that sort of is taking, borrowing a lot from the sort of Wilsonian, sort of American message for a world based on sort of equality between nations and sort of that sort of new era of diplomacy, new era of international affairs. And at the same time, it's married to this sort of more, in some respects, sort of Bolshevik or Maoist revolutionary underground organization that has guerrilla fighters, that has terrorist wings, that is trying to create sort of propaganda apparatus, that is using the sort of cell techniques of underground mobilization, organization, and politicization the communist world has proven, at least in terms of the methodologies of political mobilization, are extremely effective, to the point that if you're looking at the minutes of sort of Algerian nationalist figures, they're taking documents. They'll take Soviet communist documents and materials and sort of revolutionary, kind of using as a revolutionary instruction guide. And I'll often go through and sort of, at least in the early years, just kind of copy many of the same language wholesale and push it into some of their own documents and their own material to train their own political commissars and so on. But they'll excise overtly ideological terminology. Sort of they'll get rid of references to, say, the proletariat, and they'll just replace it with the nation and that kind of thing. So it's very, very explicitly and literally about taking the praxis of revolution and taking whatever praxis has a demonstrated record of success. Taking that, but not necessarily, at least in theory, not necessarily taking on board all of the sort of ideological baggage or context that can come with these different examples that they're sort of borrowing from and putting together. I then argue that this is very successful in the short term, but it's also, I think it has long-term consequences that are complicated and perhaps still linger in Algeria today, that this sort of sense of a deliberate effort to sort of depoliticize the nation and the revolution and political identity, I think kind of creates a lingering sense of ideological crisis or a sort of identity crisis feeds into that in the longer term. And there's a deliberate search when you look by the early 60s, the latter stages of the war independence, on into the post-independence period, you'll see, you can see the sort of similar conversations going on where they're now saying, we have an ideological deficit, that we're not ideological enough, we need to be more ideological. There's amongst various sort of leading elements in the Algerian political and intellectual scene. Which I think is an interesting dimension. It's also something which I'm more aware of now, perhaps, is that I wouldn't say a universal phenomenon, but a very widespread phenomenon across much of the colonial and post-colonial world in the sort of 40s, 50s, and 60s. I'm struck by how often, if I'm reading things, even especially sort of reading for teaching, and you might be reading about areas that I knew less about, and I often find people, many coming from many different kinds of sort of political groups and different elements of different places in the political spectrum, but around that same general era, making the same case, saying, well, we need to prioritize action over sort of philosophizing, and this sense of impatience, the importance of praxis, the importance of action, explicitly defining revolution as something that a person does, not as that the revolution is distinguished by the actions that people are willing to take rather than the cause in whose name they take those actions.
So this question of this like strategic choice made by the Algerians to sort of eschew doctrinal debates and privilege, sort of like the practice of state making, had consequences internationally. And one of those is, the Algerians became friends with a surprisingly ideologically diverse coterie of allies, from around the world, different ideologies, different state-making projects, different anti-colonial projects. And this is essentially the title of your book, Algiers became a Mecca of revolution. And so how did this happen? How did this approach to ideology and practice lead to Algiers becoming this site of so much revolutionary and confusing energy?
That's the topic that really brought me to the subject and to the project in the first place. That Algeria and Algiers, perhaps in particular, really emerges after independence, in fact, even before independence, while the war is still going on, as one of, it's not the only one, but there's a few sort of places around the world during this sort of, this era of decolonization, and we can sort of, get into what decolonization means, a slightly different question, but, the 50s, 60s, 70s, and there's these places, there's huge revolutionary foment around the world, especially in the Southern Hemisphere, the colonial world, the third world, global south, whatever sort of frame you want to use, all sorts of different movements, anti-colonial movements of different stripes, some overtly socialist and Marxist, others being overtly anti-Marxist, and so on. And there's this whole spirit of anti-colonial internationalism, anti-colonial solidarity, but there's certain places where they seem to really be these sort of networks of support, and revolutionaries are sort of traveling around the world. And there's a few places where are sort of particularly intense sites where people are coming together and exchanging ideas and cooperating. And Algiers is one of those places in the 60s and 70s. It becomes the Algiers War of Independence was extremely inspirational to many people in the world, especially in the colonial world. At that point in time, they waged this massive war, hundreds of thousands of lives lost, ultimately gained their independence from France. France essentially does everything it can, and in practical terms, successive French governments to try to win that war and hold on to Algeria, devoting massive military resources to that ultimately failed endeavor, military and political resources, and economic. And so it shows that if anti-colonial revolution, if European imperialism and colonialism can be overthrown in Algeria, it can be overthrown anywhere. That no situation is impossible, no matter how improbable success seems, no matter how great the odds seem stacked against you. I mean, they couldn't have tried harder than they did in the Algerian case, and so it's not the only one, but it became another great example for would-be revolutionaries. The notion that what seems foolhardy, what might seem foolhardy, perhaps even suicidal, that can be done. And so many come, and Algerians themselves received a great deal of international support during the War of Independence, both in terms of other countries that sort of formally diplomatically supported them, which was especially sort of newly independent countries in Asia, say, other Arab countries in the Middle East, the wider Middle East area, the sort of communist countries, the Eastern European countries, and so on, China. And also, so that there's that sort of a formal diplomatic support that they got. Many countries sent actual munitions and material support, communist China again, Yugoslavia, and then sort of later on sort of other parts of the communist bloc, and countries like Egypt and so on, sort of gave concrete material support, but they also just took a lot of inspiration from the continuing process of decolonization that was going on around them. After all, the Algerian War of Independence begins in 1954, it isn't concluded until 1962, and what you see happening during those years is that almost the entirety of the continent of Africa becomes... this sounds like a terribly sort of a vague abstract term, but becomes decolonized during that process. Not all of it, but most of it. So there's this massive change. So many of the newly independent countries to the south of them in Africa, they also are gaining a lot of, I think what's particularly perhaps particularly important is the sort of moral support and encouragement they get, because it's suggests that the big gamble that they've taken, that history is on their side, launching this war of national liberation, which will most of the people who begin the FLN are killed or captured quite quickly. The life expectancy of a mujahid or a sort of a guerrilla fighter is not terribly long. But they take this gamble that their reading of history is right, that they've read the historical moment correctly, that imperialism is over, that they just need to sort of have the courage to, you know, kick the legs out from under it. And so other parts of Africa in particular are sort of gaining their independence in this period, and they're lending support to the Algerians, or at least most of them in any case, but in practical terms, the support can't be that significant. But it all sort of reinforces this strong, ultimately correct argument that the FLN, the Algerian independence movement, represents the sort of irresistible force of history, that you can't, it's foolish of the French to try to prevent this. And so I think this sense of international solidarity, both in concrete terms and in this sort of sense of philosophical existential validation, is very strong in Algeria and many other places, but in Algeria after 62. And so they have, in fact, even before the War of Independence is over, the FLN starts supporting other national liberation movements from other parts of the developing world. And after 62, when they get their own independence, the Algerian state greatly extends this and gives a great deal of support to people coming from practically, you know, many people come from Southern Africa in particular, from South America, Argentina, in fact, some coming from Europe as well. And as you move into the 70s, you get more coming from the West, people from sort of African-American activists, Quebecois nationalists, the Irish nationalists from Northern Ireland, for that matter, and this kind of thing. Palestinian nationalists, of course, are a big one. And they have a very extensive and generous and sort of, you know, I wouldn't say unrestrained, but sort of remarkably extensive especially in the early years, very open policy of just supporting revolutionary movements and national liberation movements that come and ask for it. And that means they'll give them training, military training, as well as political training. They'll let them open offices and conduct sort of PR, diplomatic campaigns, that they'll train their fighters in the Algerian army's own sort of camps, that they'll give them passports, give them Algerian passports, allow them travel around the world as Algerian passport holders, send them on to other places like Communist China, Cairo, Accra and Ghana, at least in the early mid-60s, to other places that are sort of, or Havana for that matter, other places that are sympathetic. And it just becomes this amazing place where so many, the sheer numbers of people are relatively small. You're talking about thousands, say. But that's what makes it all remarkable. So many people who end up becoming quite important in the histories of their own countries or different sort of political movements, you know, pass through, sort of rub shoulders, talk to one another, share notes, support one another. And so, you know, this whole concept of sort of anti-colonial solidarity, anti-colonial internationalism, that it's really real. And it really is, it's not just sort of nice talk and rhetoric, that it's actually practiced and has very long-term ramifications.
One of those one of those like international projects that Algeria really becomes involved in is the non-aligned movement. Mm-hmm. And you have a really fascinating discussion of non-alignment, and so I'd love for you to parse it out for our listeners. You suggest that like the emergence of non-alignment was not abstention from the Cold War, rather it was a strategy that weak and poor countries could pursue so they could wage the Cold War to their own advantage. Can you kind of break this down for our listeners?
Yeah. So on the one hand, I'm looking a lot at sort of these relations between revolutionary movements and after independence, Algeria's relations with different revolutionary movements. On the other hand, I also look a lot at Algeria's sort of more more formal foreign policy and diplomatic actions. And if you're looking at the Third World in that era, straight away you have these entities, the non-aligned movement, Afro-Asianism, the Bangdong Conference, mm-hmm. and the sort of the Organization of African Unity, say, all these different sort of this new diplomatic landscape and terminology that's emerging in the decolonizing world. And there's a lot more, I think, interest and attention on that subject in general in the last sort of 10 years or so. Other people working on it. I talked to a lot of graduate students who are sort of working on aspects of this. Bangdong, the Bangdong Conference in 1954, 55 gets a lot of recognition these days now compared to the past, notions of Afro-Asian solidarity. And so one of the challenges I found is figuring out what these entities and these terms, non-alignment, Afro-Asianism, sort of third worldism, so what do they all mean in practice? There's a lot of skeptical thought, both at the time and by scholars working after the fact, that thinks that a lot of it is sort of, you know, doesn't amount to much, and there's a lot of sort of grand speeches and sort of heads of state and sort of diplomats and so on getting together and sort of making a bunch of grand statements and about decolonization and so on, but it doesn't amount to much. I disagree with that, but one of the things I found is I certainly disagree that it all doesn't amount to much. In fact, I think it had very significantly changed the global history in the latter half of the 20th century. But the specific issue of non-alignment that I was looking at is that I found that the Algerians and many like-minded peers around the world that they're talking to, what I found looking at their conversations, say, is that they themselves are very conscious of the fact that, okay, how do we make Afro-Asianism a foreign policy? How do we make non-alignment a foreign policy? And they themselves had these discussions about, we don't want these just to be a bunch of terms that we throw around and it all sounds great. How do I instruct my ambassadors to sort of go out and practice a non-aligned or sort of, you know, Afro-Asian internationalist foreign policy? Hmm. The terms are not interchangeable. Things like Afro-Asianism, non-alignment, and so on, they don't mean exactly the same thing. They're often sort of thrown together rhetorically. People speechifying, saying, oh, we support Afro-Asianism, we support non-alignment, we support African unity, we support Arab unity. But in practice, that's diplomacy, that's politics, that's oratory, sorry. But behind the scenes, they themselves are saying, so what does this mean? And which is more important? I mean, I have to decide what we're working on this morning. So is Arab unity more important than African unity? Is non-alignment more important than Afro-Asianism? And this kind of thing. And so what I found is that, especially in the early 60s, around the founding of the non-aligned movement in 61, that it's very much a sort of that there's slightly smaller and medium-sized third world countries are sort of in the driver's seat for that, and including Yugoslavia in that sort of in this category where the movement was founded, of course. And for them, non-alignment was not this notion of sort of, yes, it meant sort of non-alignment in terms of independence in Cold War terms, that you weren't allied with, you weren't sort of the, you know, a satellite or a puppet of sort of one of the superpowers or some other great power, that you were pursuing an independent foreign policy. You weren't sort of tied into one bloc or another. You were outside the blocs. But at the same time, they very much conceived of it as a sort of provocative foreign policy doctrine. They spoke of it as being active, that it's not passive, because one sort of school of thought that they're pushing back on this issue is particularly that it's not the only one, perhaps the most important, the Indian government's policy, at least at that time, which was more purely one of sort of not getting mixed up in the fray of the Cold War and sort of the back and forth, a sort of standing back and sort of having a sort of dignified not getting embroiled in sort of international contentions and Cold War contentions. And some of the smaller countries that are really in the driver's seat and the founding of the non-aligned movement and sort of advocating the policy at the time, Yugoslavia, Algeria is one of them, Egypt and so on. Cuba is a good example. Cuba's relationship with the non-aligned is interesting, of course, because it is a very close ally of the Soviet Union. But they're arguing that it should be It means independence. You're not one of the blocs. You're not in the Soviet bloc or the American bloc, but you can have relations with both if you want, and close relations, but also that you can sort of get embroiled in international affairs and international contentions, and that you can sort of provoke things. And what I found, I mean, this is behind closed doors. This is what people are saying to one another. So there's lots of conversations along these lines, Algerian political figures talking to sort of Malian political figures or Indonesian counterparts, Yugoslavian and their Egyptian, and they're sort of, in public, non-alignment is, about promoting peace, ending the Cold War, ending the nuclear arms race and so on. But in private, they're saying that they need to, it can be desirable to, in a sense, escalate the Cold War, to provoke tensions between the superpowers or between the superpowers and sort of secondary powers like Britain and France and communist China. And their argument is that this is how they can best maximize their influence and actually get positive, beneficial attention from the great powers. It's not the only example, but the most obvious example, say, would be economic aid. And you can see people saying quite clearly, a senior Malian figure, for example, and they can say to their Indian counterparts that they're having friendly disagreements about this over, because they are still, I don't want to make it sound like they're sort of enemies, but they have a different perspective. And they can say, you're a massive country. You're India, hundreds of millions of people. Everyone is going to give you economic assistance. Everyone is going to sort of answer your calls. Your sheer size, okay, fine, you're poor at the moment, but people answer your calls. They want to give you economic assistance. They compete for your attention and your favor, and compete for influence with you. As I said, I think the example I'm thinking of it was a Malian figure quite explicitly saying, but how do I get the Americans to care about my country? How do I get them to give me hundreds of millions of dollars of development assistance, or the Soviets for that matter? We're just not big. We're not, not sort of self-evidently important in the sort of international race for influence and favor and that kind of thing, the international competition. And so they saying this to one another that it could be beneficial that non-alignment, not publicly, but at least for many of the countries sort of leading the founding of the non-aligned movement and so on, especially in the 60s, saying that it could be useful to sort of stir a sense of competition between the great powers. You can give the impression that you're leaning towards one ideologically, that you're sort of, starting to follow the Soviet model, and then maybe the Americans will get concerned enough to start giving you economic assistance to sort of, steer you back away from the Soviets and to sort of gain influence and ideological influence in this country. And so it's deliberately provocative, or at least in many cases is. And it's also, of course, dangerous. Especially as you start to get into the sort of mid late 60s, how many sort of coups and governments are there that are overthrown? Sometimes there might be sort of the direct intervention of the CIA, say, in various places. Other times it's maybe a bit more indirect, either the Soviets or the Americans or the British. It's a dangerous policy, sort of deliberately stoking great power tensions and Cold War tensions around your poor developing post-colonial country. There can be benefits. It's better than being ignored is the calculation. But of course, the margin for error is very slim. And there's a lot of people that end up being overthrown, arrested, executed, and so on, because perhaps you sort of gamble wrong. And then somebody in Washington, D.C. says, or somewhere else, but often in Washington, D.C. says, okay, let's get rid of these people and replace them with a government we like a lot more.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's a dangerous game, but it's also sort of a game that Algerians and others are really embracing. And this is like a really interesting facet to your book, just how the prospect for peace, between the Soviet Union and the U.S. Actually did appear as a threat mm-hmm. to sort of like the Algerian state. And so for, this is kind of jumping ahead of the story, but in the 1970s with detente, there was a real fear among Algerian leaders and politicos that, you know, that like the sort of like this spheres of influence agreement between the Soviet Union and the U.S. would actually limit their ability to get aid from those countries. And then moreover, President Benbala regularly voiced concern about the hotline built between the Kremlin and D.C., the famous hotline you know, that was built after the Cuban Missile Crisis. And so you do provide really key evidence that like the Cold War is not irrelevant to this story at all. And it's actually something that you know, people within Algeria were, in some cases, stoking.
Yeah, absolutely. This is the kind of thing that actually is a good example of what I feel the Algerian archives and the Algerian sources really conveyed to me that I wouldn't have got if I didn't have those. The sort of the difference in perspectives. And you can see quite explicit conversations about this kind of thing, about, say, détente and the reduction of Cold War tensions. You can see that as early as 1961, where there's the term détente is starting to get bandied about because Khrushchev is sort of making overtures to Kennedy, and they have there's a summit of some of the great powers in Paris in 61, and this term détente is sort of getting bandied around, and things then sort of escalate again. But even then, and this is something that I mention, a specific sort of conversation along these lines that I mentioned in the book, it's the Indonesian foreign minister, for example, he's talking to sort of like-minded people from the Algerian nationalist movement, the Egyptian government, Yugoslav government, and so on. And they're quite explicitly saying that they don't like the idea of détente. It concerns them. And that this, you'll see this sort of discourse come back in much more strongly in the 1970s when détente sort of really happens, at least for several years. But from the get-go, is the early 60s, the concept of détente, the sort of reduction in Cold War tensions worries them, which is interesting because that's the opposite of what most of the sort of public discourse about post-colonial international affairs is about. That's not what the discourse at the Bangdan conference is about. It's not what the non-aligned movement sort of official proclamation say. They say they want the Cold War to end, reduction in tensions. But in practice, they say, well, this means that without tensions, you know, who's going to care about us? Who's going to give us economic assistance? Who's going to kind of give us other forms of support? And when you think about it and you go back and you see their reference points, it's striking how much, well, I suppose, as we would expect, people who are living, coming of age and sort of becoming political figures in the late colonial and post-colonial period, for them, the Cold War is about imperialism. It's another facet of imperial competition. And that's something that, in theory, we know that, and in theory, sort of, you know, American foreign policymakers at the time sort of knew that. But they're sort of knowing it and sort of really understanding what that means and appreciating what that means. And you realize that for them, for the sort of the colonial world or the third world, the global south, that for them, if you think about all the sort of great sort of, you know, the annals of big, great sort of peacemaking diplomacy, but for them, it's synonymous with the sort of non-European world or the sort of the non-North or the non-white world, I guess, essentially, that for them, that means the non-white world getting divvied up by the great power makers. You know, you go back to the Berlin conference in Africa, for example, as a sort of the most famous example. But the same thing happens in 1919 at the Versailles conference. They are, you know, they feel that the sort of the same thing happens in 1945. And so for them, they feel like détente, oh yeah, the reduction tensions between East and West, like we know what that means. The great powers make peace amongst one another by getting out the maps and divvying up the world between them. That's how we became colonized in the first place. That's what peacemaking amongst the great powers means. And so it's fascinating because it's just coming from this whole different sort of perspective, from which Aswood makes total sense, that the sort of imperial sort of horse trading amongst the great powers is, for them, the most important defining characteristic of some of these big conferences, the Versailles Conference and this kind of thing, the Versailles Peace Conference. It's not some sort of relatively minor detail. For them, that's the defining characteristic. And so there's just a suspicion of diplomacy, great power diplomacy, peacemaking, which I think, and it's one of the things that I think that the legacies of this diplomatic culture, political culture, the legacies of this sort of collective historical memory still applies today, still evident today. And it's also a clear example of where there is one of the striking things about this sort of sense of anti-colonial internationalism, third world solidarity, is the great sense of commonality that they feel. And it's striking that there's so many things that, you know, what does sort of Algeria and Indonesia have in common? In many respects, not a lot. They're very different places. Or you could pick any two countries really from the Southern Hemisphere in this era, but they feel this strong sense of commonality because they find that there's many things straight away when they start having first conversations that they do agree about. And one of them is this sort of shared historical memory, this sort of the sense of global history from the colonized perspective, and that there's your sort of default mode. If people talk about the Versailles Peace Conference, what that means to you, and sort of if people talk about the prospect of détente. There's many examples, but that's one of the clear thing. That's one clear example of they soon realize, like, oh yeah, we see that the same way. And so, despite all the infinite differences between the different places in the decolonizing and post-colonial world, that there's a lot of, if not universally, but extremely widely shared perspectives and attitudes on a range of issues.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, I think what this really shows is that, like, realpolitik was something that was practiced even amongst revolutionaries.
Mm. Mm. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, nobody has to be more pragmatic than the weak.
Exactly. Yeah, that's well put.
One of my challenges, not sure exactly how well I succeeded, but one of my challenges was to convey, if you're sort of writing about international affairs or sort of, foreign policy or diplomacy for any country, there's, that sort of debate, sort of realpolitik versus ideology and so on and so forth. And one of my challenges was there's not a clear roadmap if you're talking about Algeria from that perspective. There's not sort of a huge literature to sort of position yourself against. And I wanted to convey that, both are true at once, which I think is probably the case for just about anywhere, that people have ideologies, both conscious and unconscious. And in the Algerian case, politically influential people generally had a pretty, they had unconscious ideologies as well, but certainly also had very sort of conscious ideologies and ideological differences amongst them. But they were also very thought of themselves as being very pragmatic, had to be pragmatic. And so the interaction between the two, I found very interesting. And often they were quite frank amongst themselves and to others about where they're sort of sacrificing their principles, at least in the short term, for expedient reasons.
Mm-hmm. So just moving ahead a little bit, another thing about your book that struck me was the discussion about how Algerian anti-colonialism and decolonization and state making, and how that related to the interstate system itself. You have a really interesting and perhaps counterintuitive argument, which is that, like, even though Algeria was like a product of transnationalism and it embraced all these transnational connections, when you actually take a look at it retrospectively, you can see how the Algerian case actually helped entrench the interstate system, and maybe the same can go for other post-colonial regimes. Like these revolutionaries ended up becoming quite conservative in their dealings with state and sovereignty.
Mm. Yeah, I do try to grapple with what I think of as the conservatism of decolonization. There's many radical, revolutionary aspects of decolonization, speaking in broad brush terms. But there's also some quite conservative aspects of decolonization. And I think that's true in with respect to sort of international relations theories. As a sort of theory of international relations, third worldism, if we'll call it that, sort of anti-colonial internationalism, is a kind of a conservative traditionalist sort of theory of international relations. It's very state-based, nation-based, state-centric, nation-centric. It puts, and the things I'm saying, I think, are very true of the Algerian case. I think they're, you know, perhaps not universally true, but are sort of on the whole, in the aggregate, largely true of sort of the third worldism in the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s. It conceives of a world that's is large, that is composed of nations and states and nation states. So it's kind of traditionalist in that sense. It puts very great emphasis on interstate relations, in part because interstate relations then themselves sort of validate those states. One of the most important aspects of post-colonial diplomacy is that it is interstate, and it's just a sort of constant reinforcement of the reality and the existence of the nation state, that it's engaged in this stuff. That's why there's a very, the Algerians are good examples of this, how there's a very great emphasis on the sort of pageantry and sort of protocols and ritualism of diplomacy, to the point that there's, you'll find some, especially people sort of coming from sort of Western European countries or sort of US figures, sometimes might be complaining about how much sticklers for protocols, say the Algerians are. And I certainly see them complaining that about in the Algerian context. In fact, even still up until the present day, I've had the opportunity to converse with, and this instance, sort of American diplomats working the Algerians, complaining about how they're sticklers for sort of protocol. And so there's this kind of conservatism to it, because of course, the greatest success of the Algerian revolution, the greatest success of sort of most sort of third worldist anti-colonial revolution movements along those lines, is the greatest success in a sense is one that they can't directly call attention to, which is to establish them gaining independence, sure, of course, and they do talk about that, but convincing you and convincing Algerians that Algeria is a thing, that the Algerian nation is this self-evident truth. And if you accept that argument, then it becomes very difficult for you, even in 1960, 1961, to argue that Algeria should not be independent if you recognize it as a nation. It's why the French argue very strongly that Algeria is not a nation, because they don't want to be arguing that nations should not have their independence. And so it's not, and I don't mean to, and this is for, you know, the much of the post-colonial world, not all of it, in fact, any country in the world, really, but the nation is not a self-evident reality, but especially in those contexts. And so diplomacy and the sort of formality of diplomacy and sort of statism and these kind of things, it's kind of traditionalist in the sense, and they're sort of, because all of those things just reinforce the sense that, this is a nation, that this nation and its state exist. If we didn't exist, then why the heck do we have diplomats who are sort of, you know, giving speeches and standing in front of flags and this kind of thing? And of course, it's about convincing Algerians as much as it is convincing sort of Americans and French and Soviets and so on. It has, sort of has a double audience. The conservatism of decolonization has many aspects. Of course, we could get into sort of cultural conservatism and these kind of things, these things that become very pressing concerns in post-colonial politics in Algeria and many other places, dynamics that are still being played out in many parts of the world today. But, to give concrete examples, I think it's manifested in this sort of in political concepts, political formulations. They're fighting for a nation state. They're deliberately presenting themselves to the international community, the great powers, in a sense, arguing that, you know, if as is true in so many of these sort of counterinsurgency and sort of counter-revolutionary contexts, the French are, you know, their public position is that Algeria is not a country. The FLN, they're just bandits and killers and murderers and thugs, whereas the Algerians will be going to say, especially to perhaps more skeptical audiences or audiences that have, for various reasons, are, you know, inclined to support the French position, the Americans in particular, saying, well, we're not radical at all. We're just nationalists. We're patriots. We just want an independent country. They go to great pains to... the power dynamics, of course, at play are very interesting because, of course, they'll, you know, the sticklers for protocol, they'll always be sort of wearing suits and sort of dressing conservatively and this kind of thing because they're conveying, in a sense, a sort of conservatism. They're like, you know, the French are, don't listen to the French. They said we're a bunch of killers and thugs and sort of Islamic fundamentalists and this kind of thing. We actually couldn't be any more boring. You know, we're just fighting. We're just fighting for our independence. And of course, that's presenting yourself to a certain audience. But it also makes sense. This, you know, experience of the War of Independence, and even after independence, when, you know, they're pushing together a state, pushing together a foreign ministry, as so many post-colonial countries, they don't have a lot of resources. They're pretty broke. They don't have a lot of resources in terms of necessarily trained personnel and administrative personnel and this kind of thing, and so. But they also don't want to look like the poor cousins in diplomatic circles. So they make a particular point of sort of conducting themselves with a dignified bearing and being sort of sticking to the formulae of and the protocols and so on, so that no one can not take you seriously as a diplomat.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, you provide an abundance of evidence to support this. Like one of them, and I thought this was so fascinating, was just how they, they joined organizations like the UN, which represented the interstate system, par excellence. Mm. They would create new agencies within the UN, like the UN Conference on Trade and Development. But they were participating in this club that only sovereign states could be a part of. And then this becomes even clearer in the 1970s, which is really fascinating because the historiography has really been thinking about this in terms of almost like the golden age of third worldism. An example at the 1970 non-aligned movement summit in Zambia, you show how the discussions were all about the reinforcement of state sovereignty and state authority. So conversations about tariffs and borders and things like that. It really does become clear that this post-colonial world is it really does look like kind of like the in many ways the old interstate system with new members.
I would argue that is the case. This is why decolonization ends up looking the way it does, which isn't, I'm not the only scholar to point this out, certainly Frederick Cooper in particular sort of made this case looking at West Africa, but it's not self-evident that decolonization means the whole world turning into independent sovereign states that in many, at least the sort of in abstract theoretical terms, are identical, and they have foreign ministries, and they have a delegation at the UN, and a flag flying at the UN, and this kind of thing. And it's remarkable in sort of abstract structural terms, in terms of the structures of international relations. It's a remarkable homogenization of the world. If you look at the imperial era, if you look at the imperial order, I mean, it's actually total. It's total mess in structural terms. I mean, if you were just looking at the British Empire, as, you know, people point out, let alone even comparing it. So you have huge swaths of the world and in Africa, Asia in particular, that are part of this British Empire thing. But what they mean, they have all these territories with sort of different legal status and sort of different terminologies. And, you know, if you look at India, there's sort of these sort of independent states within it, and they have different statuses, even apart from different colonial territories. The French Empire, perhaps they make a bit of an effort to, at least sort of in the blueprints, to maybe homogenize things a bit more. But I would argue that, you know, the sort of, and I know where people are coming from. I mean, in a sense, both can be true at the same time, but the narrative that the world is sort of becoming more complex and states are becoming less important and everything, that this is what's happening in the late 20th century, I think is bizarre in the sense that, in reality, it seems to be that in terms of the formal structures of how, which have power, the formal structures of international affairs become very codified and made much more uniform and homogenized in the sort of mid, late 20th century. That you get all of these, obviously what happens within the states varies massively, but at least on paper, in terms of how international affairs works, the sovereign states are have certain basic traits in common, which is not at all what most of the world looks like until sort of 1945 or so, which is not to say the UN is represents a big change to international affairs. And I don't deny that. And there's a revolutionary aspect to that. But the post-colonial countries, the third world countries, are amongst those arguing extremely forcefully in these conversations, very much applying current events today, that the UN is a club of states. It's a club for states. So in that sense, it very much reinforces national sovereignty and state sovereignty, because it creates this exclusive club that only states can belong to. And the same can be said of a lot of the other key institutions of the international order, IMF, World Bank, and so on. You know, they don't deal with guerrilla movements, or they don't deal with, yeah, you know, they don't, the World Bank doesn't issue loans to a caliphate. No, the World Bank issue loans to a sovereign state. So there's this sort of, you know, these institutions, these things have power, which is why, even though you'll have sort of avowedly socialist countries such as Algeria that are publicly and privately skeptical of the World Bank and the IMF and see them as sort of tools for American economic imperialism, but at the same time, they desperately want membership of them and fight for it, not just because you can get loans, but also because it's one more confirmation that if they want to be in the big global clubs for states. That means nobody can deny your nationality. Nobody can deny your sort of validity of your nation state. So then these debates about how the all of these new institutions for international affairs are arguing very forcefully that these institutions should be things that enhance the primacy and the sort of moral and political monopolies of sovereign states, not detract from them. So that's certainly the case for the UN, and sort of it's sort of human rights debates is where this plays out really dramatically over the past couple of decades. Also peacekeeping, this kind of thing. But if you see, say, the founding of the Organization of African Unity, precursor to the African Union today, in 63. So they're having these debates themselves when post-colonial countries get to create their own institutions. And so the OAU is a very good example where they have this conversation quite explicitly. They say, the OAU is a club for states, and we're not going to create something that will be seen as a moral or political rival for power to the sovereign, the constituent nation states. So they make a point of saying that the sort of the Secretary General of the OAU is not, that they make a point of sort of watering down the powers of that position. So there's nothing that will either symbolically, morally, or in basic sort of political pragmatic politics challenge the primacy of states.
Great. I think that's a wonderful place to sort of leave the discussion of the book.
Great.
And I've already taken up a lot of your time already today.
It's been a pleasure.
Okay, great. Well, I would love to know what you're working on right now.
Well, I'm working on the next book. A couple of shorter writing projects. Actually, have a just got an email that I have a piece in a roundtable on decolonization, what it means for the Middle East. That's coming out in the Journal of Middle East Studies in the next, I think, in the next few weeks. And the book I'm working on right now is The Rise and Fall of Anti-Colonial Internationalism. So some of the same themes I've been talking about, which is perhaps why in some of the comments I've been making, I've been talking about more recent events, because these are some of the things that are in my mind, and my book, the book I'm currently working on, is chronologically moving up to the sort of the end of the 20th century. You know, stay tuned for that.
We will. I'm really excited for that project. Again, Jeff, I really want to thank you for coming onto the program.
Thanks very much, Dexter. I appreciate this.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun. My former advisor, also the person that I also TA'd for, it's good to be speaking with you. And you've been listening to New Books in History. I've been speaking with Jeff Byrne about his book, Mecca of Revolution, Algeria, Decolonization, and the Third World Order.